tonight I want to talk again about this theme of how the self gets formed. In my first talk in this retreat, we looked at that question from the point of view of perception and then the proliferating thoughts that express various kinds of self-concern. Last week, we talked about this formation in terms of the five aggregates, how if we claim any of the aggregates as I or mine, self is formed in that claiming. Tonight, I want to examine the formation through the schema of dependent origination, which is considered one of the most original and profound insights of the Buddha. And in addition, I want to start to swing over to talk not only about how the self gets formed, which is a kind of bondage, but how release happens. So the first half of the talk is going to be about bondage, and it's somewhat analytical. So pay close attention. But the second half of the talk is about freedom, and it's not as analytical, and so don't pay too close attention. In the second half, I want you to just kind of pick up a mood more than anything else. It's not meant to be as conceptual, but more the feeling of release. I'll let you know when it shifts. So the subject of the talk, the title of this talk is Unentangled Knowing. This is a word that was used by Tanisaro Bhikkhu in translating a Thai teacher from the past century, a woman teacher named Upasika Ki. He collected a bunch of her talks, recorded discourses, and translated in a really wonderful book called Pure and Simple. I recommend it highly to you. I find it a very inspiring Dhamma collection. And there are two things that are really interesting about Upasika Ki as a teacher. One is she's a woman. And you may have noticed that in the last, 100 years of teachings, there haven't been a lot of strong women teachers in our tradition. If you look back to Asia, most of the teaching has come through monks. So she is a woman. She taught from about the 1950s into the 1970s and died sometime in the 1970s. The second thing that's interesting is that she was a laywoman. She didn't even take the white-robed ordination of Meichi, or a simple nun in Thailand, but she remained a laywoman. And her teachings are profound, accurate, deep, motivating. It's a really beautiful collection that is in the book. So this phrase, unentangled knowing, was Tanisaro's translation of one of her lines. And just to explain this word, if you're not an English speaker natively, unentangled is an odd word. We don't use it that often in English. So you probably know tangle is when different threads of stuff get all twisted together and form a knot or a mass. It's like if you go riding in a convertible and the top's down, your hair will get tangled. My hair will not, but your hair may. It's also, what happens when a kitten plays with a ball of yarn. Play with it for 5 minutes and it makes this mess that you can't pull apart. That's tangle. Entangle is the verb that means to make a tangle happen. Unentangle is the negation of the verb. So it means that nothing is getting entangled. When paired with knowing, it refers to a kind of mindfulness that's not caught up in and conflicted in relation to the things that it's knowing, in relation to its objects. So this is what's pointed to in this phrase, and we'll approach it from a few different directions. The Buddha used this image of a tangle quite often in the suttas to describe the normal condition of the heart and mind. Here's one quote. The world is smothered and enveloped by craving like a tangled ball of yarn. Enveloped by craving like a tangled ball of yarn. You get this picture of how our different desires form conflicts that can't all be satisfied at once. You know, just like a simple example, wanting to be ourselves and wanting people to like us. But you can't always do both of those. So our wants get complicated. Then there's this wonderful question that somebody posed to the Buddha that was taken and forms the introduction to the Visuddhimagga, this 6th century commentary. The questioner said, "A tangle inside and a tangle outside. This generation is entangled in a tangle. So I ask of Gautama this question, who succeeds in disentangling this tangle?" The answer, the Buddha says, is that it's one who follows the path of virtue, meditation, and wisdom, which is what we're doing here. So our practice is already leading in the direction of disentangling this tangle. Upasaka Ki is pointing to a kind of way of being in her quote, and I'll read it now. "An inward staying, unentangled knowing, all outward turning cast aside." So we'll explain that more as we go, but this is kind of the central theme of this talk. So it points to a state of mind where we're fully aware, we're fully in touch with all the different objects arising in our field of experience, but we're not caught up in relation to them. We're not fixed. We're not in a relationship of greed, aversion, or delusion to them. This unentangled knowing is happening for us, for those of us in the middle of this practice period, at many moments during the day, but we normally don't recognize them. So part of the reason for this talk is just to encourage us all to start tuning in to when these moments are happening, because there's something a little profound going on in these moments. Even if they don't arrive with a lot of punch, there's still something that's coming through that's significant. So I want to explain also what that is. And then toward the end, I want to just describe a couple of specific approaches to meditation that lead in this general direction. The last piece is a little bit of a warning. It's kind of a caveat. The language I'm going to use in the talk tonight, a lot of it comes from the Thai forest tradition. Upasaka Ki was in that tradition. Thanissaro Bhikkhu is in that tradition. And many teachers that you've probably heard of. Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mahabua, Ajahn Buddhadasa, Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Man. These teachers all share a common sort of philosophy and view, and their language tends to be similar. They will use similar concepts to explain meditation practice. However, it's quite different from the language and the view of the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition, which we've also talked about quite a bit. That's a more kind of, I'd say, classical Theravadan view based on the Abhidhamma and the Visuddhimagga and commentaries that would view some of the Thai forest language as rather heretical. So what I like about the Western Vipassana scene is I feel it's bringing together these two streams. We have the Thai forest influence, and you'll feel it here when the monks and nuns come to teach. Ajahn Amro, Ajahn Suchito, Ananda Bodhi, Bhikkhuni, Ayamedanandi, Bhikkhuni. And, you know, the grounding in the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition. So tonight I'm going to talk from the viewpoint of the Thai forest, and if it rubs the wrong way because you're more in the Mahasi Sayadaw, I apologize. But I find them both really helpful in my own practice and view, so I wanted to share a bit of that. All right. So first we're going to go into the description of how bondage is created, how this sense of self is formed through the mode of dependent origination. Dependent origination is a teaching that traces the origin of suffering in moment-to-moment detail through a series of 12 links that starts with ignorance and goes through a kind of causal relationship through other links and arrives at suffering. The understanding is once we have reached suffering, suffering reinforces the quality of ignorance and the cycle starts again. It's a self-perpetuating, self-reinforcing circle of causes and conditions that overall serve to keep beings trapped in samsara, trapped on the wheel of birth and death. I'm not going to cover the whole of the 12 links. That would be a great talk. It would be a different talk. I just want to focus on the central links because they're very practical. So I'm going to skip the first 5 links of the chain because they get philosophical and people argue about them. And I'm going to skip the last 3 links of the chain because they also get philosophical and people argue about them. They're kind of confusing. So what we're going to look at tonight are the central 4 links, which I think form the heart, especially in terms of our practice of dependent origination. So we start with our basic experience of life as a human being, which we've talked about a number of times, and which the Buddha described in this lovely little discourse called the Sutta on Totality. So he was addressing a group of practitioners, and he said, bhikkhus, and you know that refers to you as practitioners, what is the totality of life? It's kind of a big question, isn't it? Listen, attend carefully, and I will teach you the totality of life. That's a pretty bold statement. Einstein never said that. Marx never said that. Freud never said that. You know, all the Western intellectual tradition didn't make such a statement. Here's the Buddha, 2,600 years ago, I will teach you the totality of life. Listen, attend carefully. It is simply the eye and sights, the ear and sounds, the nose and smells, the tongue and tastes, the body and sensations, the mind and mind objects, primarily thoughts and emotions. This is the totality of life. Anyone who would speak of a different totality than this would not know what they were speaking about. So I love the brevity of this. From the point of view of meditation practice, this is the totality that we are concerned about. It is knowing the objects that are arising at these 6 sense doors, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mind door. Seeing them clearly with mindfulness. That's it. There is nothing else. And part of the reason that we spend so much time and emphasis on exploring these 6 sense doors is so that we learn how not to get involved in suffering at any of them. If we don't explore them all carefully, then there could be some areas of unconsciousness where we get caught, we get trapped. But by this kind of relentless exploration of all these sense doors, we learn how to find our way with some freedom here. So one of the ways Joseph likes to express this teaching on totality is there are only ever 6 things happening. It's really simple. That's all we need to know. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mind objects. That's it. These things form what we've talked about as contact. I think we talked about this in relation to the Honeyball Sutta. Contact is the meeting of the sense object, the sense organ, and the sense consciousness. So, for example, a sight, a working eye, and eye consciousness. Those together form the experience of seeing, and that is called a moment of contact, eye contact. So this is the first link where we're going to pick up dependent origination. Contact is actually a further link in the chain. We're going to pick up the chain here at contact. So we understand that contact is the unfolding of these events at the six sense doors. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and the knowing of them, the consciousness of them. With contact, as we've talked about, comes a certain quality in the mind. When something impinges on us, it makes an impact in our mind that has the quality of either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. And this is the quality that we've called feeling tone, vedana in Pali, or just feeling. I'll just use feeling for short this evening. And why is feeling so important? Because when we're not mindful, it forms the basis for all the reactive formations. When a pleasant contact arises, if we don't attend carefully, we are apt to respond with greed, some form of wanting. When an unpleasant contact arises, we're apt to respond with aversion, disliking, pushing away. And when a neither, or let's say neutral object, arises, we're apt to kind of space out and ignore it with the formation of delusion. Feeling is the next link in the chain. So where there's contact, then there's feeling. And the reason feeling is important is it's the basis for these conditioned reactive formations of greed, aversion, and delusion. Taken together, greed, aversion, and delusion get referred to in the Buddha's language as craving. He used the word craving to refer to this mass of interaction of greed, aversion, and delusion, these conditioned tendencies. Craving sounds like it's only the desire force, but it includes the force of aversion, and it includes this delusion layer as well. Why? We could say that the gist of craving is wanting things to be different than they are. So it could be the desire for something more pleasant. It could also be the desire for the unpleasant to go away. So either greed or aversion are still expressions of some wanting, wanting things to be different than they are. That's the gist of craving. And the way delusion functions is it covers over that activity. You know, we talked about how greed and aversion are strategies. If we saw the strategies clearly, we'd see they didn't work and we'd drop them. Delusion covers them over. We become unconscious to what we're doing, and that allows them to continue. Together, they help form this sense of self. So craving is the next link in the chain of dependent origination. With contact, there's feeling. With feeling, if there's not mindfulness, there's craving. And then craving goes on a further step, and this is very interesting. This is the step called clinging. So this is where it's really interesting to observe in your meditation practice. As your minds get slower and more subtle, you can start to see this happening. Let's take a pleasant object as an example. Pleasant contact arises. There's an inclination of desire toward it, and you can almost feel the mind leaning into it. You feel almost a gravitational pull of interest, attention. Sometimes you can even feel it physically. The mind is leaning in, and at some point, it takes a hold. There's a kind of pulling that pleasant thing out of the whole field of experience, locking in on it, and fixating on it, that is the act of grasping or clinging. So what we are drawn to by craving, we then tend to take a hold of with this action of grasping or clinging. Once we've grasped it, we've taken a hold of it and fixated on it, then we tend to proliferate around it. We make some connection to it. It matters to us. And what we care about, we start to think about, and what we think about, we proliferate about. So clinging is the next step in the chain. And these are the four links that we are going to look at in a little more detail. Contact, feeling, craving, clinging. This is the heart of dependent origination. The understanding is that once we've taken a hold of, the chain leads inexorably to suffering. Maybe subtly, maybe in a gross way. But once craving and clinging have operated, the chain goes on and ends up in suffering, which for most of us tends to reinforce the factor of ignorance and start the cycle again. This is how we get caught on this wheel. So you can kind of just, you know, take a step back and appreciate what we're exposed to as human beings. We come out of the womb where we've been protected and safe, and then we're thrown out into this world where contacts just assail us one after another, and all these objects go through our awareness, all these objects of contact, like mother, breast, food, father, school, attractions, sex, work, career, marriage, children, Britney Spears, MTV, Barack Obama, global economic crisis, goes on and on and on. How are we not going to cling to that stuff? Of course we're going to. There's such a mix, a fast mix of pleasure and pain, of scary things and comfort. So of course we're going to be trying to hold on. When we grasp, we create a self. You could say really that grasping and selfing are synonymous. We sometimes use the word grasp and sometimes use the word cling, but the Pali word is the same. It's upadana. We usually say in English, grasp, when we first take a hold of it. But then when the fixation has been going on for a while, we call it clinging. But it's the same act of holding on to one particular aspect of our experience. That means one contact we've held on. And then there's a self, because we proliferate around it, we claim it in some way or other as me or mine, and we make kind of a big deal about it. We've gotten involved with it. The problem is that the very formation of the I is also going to lead to the I passing away. And in the life or the death of the I, there's some friction. There's some suffering. Could be little, could be big. So let's take some examples. Let's say you're on a meditation retreat at IMS, and you're an eight precepts yogi, and you walk into the dining hall on a certain fall evening to get your little modest glass of juice. And as you walk into the dining hall, you smell a great aroma of pumpkin soup. And you think, oh, that smells just like the pumpkin pie my mother used to make around this time of year. And then you walk by and you see the little basket of herb bread. And it looks so soft and warm, but you're on eight precepts, unfortunately. And so you start to think, why do I have to be on eight precepts tonight? You know, I didn't take enough lunch today. I was being really moderate with my meal, and now I'm really hungry. The smells are so good. That bread looks so good. Maybe I could go off eight precepts just for one night and nobody would notice. No, I can't do that. I vowed to do it. I'm going to exercise my renunciation. But I'm really hungry tonight. I wish I hadn't done that. Why did I go on eight precepts in the first place? I really need to eat something tonight. No, but I can't. So we take that with us. The image of the herb bread, the smell of the pumpkin soup, as we go back to our room and then we come into the next meditation, we've taken birth as the hungry yogi. Because we've held on to the smell, the sight, the image of that food. So we're taking birth, we're struggling, it's not a very happy birth, and eventually, whether it's 5 minutes later or 50 minutes later, we let go of that thing we've grasped. The idea of that food, the struggle with the eight precepts, the wishing we could eat tonight, it stirs us up for a while, but eventually we let it go. This is what's so interesting about almost everything that we grasp onto. We let it go at some point or another. And one of the beautiful things of being in retreat is you can see this happen in real time. You can see the things we pick up and then the things we let go. The astute yogi wonders, why should I pick it up in the first place? Because I'm only going to let it go a little better. But these habits, contact, feeling, craving, clinging, are so strong, it's not that easy to just let it all go. So we take a birth as a hungry yogi. It lasts for a while. That birth has a certain lifetime. And then when we let it go, the hungry yogi goes away. No problem, no conflict, no longing, no hunger. It's just that birth is dissolved. It's over, finished. That was in relationship to something pleasant, to a desire force that we couldn't have. So, you know, frustrated desire. So let's take another example of a concentrated sitting. So you come in, you've been practicing really steadily for almost 4 weeks. You come into the meditation, not expecting anything special, but you sit down, and all of a sudden, you're just there. You're present with mindfulness in an effortless kind of way. The body is relaxed. There's peaceful feeling in the mind. Thoughts still arise, but none of them really take you away from mindfulness. You can see them clearly and let them go. If you turn your attention to the breath, you can follow it quite steadily. If you move into choiceless attention, you can hear every sound arising, feel every sensation, just one after the other, every moment very clear. And it feels great. And you recognize this as, wow, a really pleasant meditation. This is what I came for. This experience is what I wanted. Wow, it's lasting the whole period. Let me take it out for a walk now. Go for a walk and just every footstep, those six parts that they talked about, I can feel every one of them steadily through. The mind feels so settled and peaceful. We start thinking, gosh, this is what it's going to be like for the rest of the retreat. And I could live my life from here. I could live my whole life from this kind of place. I could go back and into my work. People will recognize how centered I am, and I'll get the promotion that I've been interested in. In my relationship, I'll never complain again. I'll just be a loving and supportive partner. This is going to be so wonderful from now on. Then we can't wait. The bell rings at the end of the walk. I can't wait to come back into the hall and sit again. So we come back, sit down, gone. Thoughts are running like crazy. Body energy is all stirred up. Can't find the breath for more than a half in-breath. Everything that we had is completely scattered. No concentration, no peace, no relaxation, no ease. Painful. So what happened? Here, we took birth as the concentrated yogi. Because we latched onto it. We thought we could claim it and take it into the future. So we took birth by grasping it. And it felt great. This was a great birth. The good yogi, the super yogi. Birth. It's kind of like a heaven realm birth. Everything is so nice and pleasant while it's going. We forget that the factors are impermanent. And it won't last. So we claim it, we've clung to it. And then when it stops, it's really painful. And it may take us quite a while to let go of the memory of that beautiful period of practice. But eventually we do, don't we? Somehow we get over this loss. We manage to be somewhat gracious in opening to the chaos that has come on the heels of the concentration, we don't lose our courage, we don't lose our persistence, we make a steady effort, and then at some point we say, it's okay. What we lost, it's okay that we lost it. The present moment is also all right, and things settle again. But what's happened is by taking this good birth, when that birth comes to an end, there's a painful death. So in the first episode, the hungry yogi was a painful birth, but the passing away was a pleasant death. In the second episode, the birth was beautiful, but the death was painful. So whichever way we take birth, out of pleasure or out of pain, there's going to be suffering involved somewhere along the way, either in the birth or in the letting go and the death of it. So we start to see that the I is really finding its foundation through this act of grasping or clinging. In fact, there is no other I apart from grasping. This was described really clearly by Andrew Olensky, who's the one of the scholars in residence at the study center just down the road. What becomes clear through this analysis of moment-to-moment experience is that grasping is not something done by the self, but rather self is something done by grasping. The self is constructed each moment for the simple purpose of providing the one who likes or doesn't like, holds on to or pushes away what is unfolding in experience. Self and grasping are more or less the same. And then you might ask, well, what does the grasping? I mean, that's an interesting thing to explore in your experience. What does the grasping? But it's a wrong question. There is nothing doing the grasping. Grasping is a faculty of mind. Mind has this ability to single something out and lock in, or you might say fixate on it. And it's that act of fixation driven by greed, aversion, and delusion that constitutes grasping. So there's an emotional push behind the act of grasping, but there's no one or thing doing it. It's just a mind's faculty that it happens. And this reminds me, this description kind of reminds me of an image that's common in Asia. If you've ever watched a monkey travel through a forest, you'll see what they do is they'll take a hold of a vine and then they'll swing on that vine until they get close to, you know, another vine, and then only when they're close enough to get to catch hold of a different vine will they let go of the first. And then they'll swing on that new vine for a while until they get to another one, and then they'll grab a hold of that. So sometimes if you look at the mind, this is what it's doing. It's just moving from one holding to another, to another, to another, moment after moment. So this is the chain. This is the heart of dependent origination. Contact, feeling, craving, clinging. Where is there any freedom in that? Are we just destined to repeat the cycle again and again and again? Okay, shifting gears. So I want to talk a little bit about this quality of freedom. The path exists to provide relief from suffering. This relief from suffering is usually described as freedom. As could be put in terms of awakening or enlightenment, but kind of the heart of the felt sense is described in terms like deliverance or liberation or release. So freedom is really where the path leads. So the question is freedom only an outcome of a very long path and period of practice? Or is there some freedom that we can sense and feel all along the way? Could freedom be a part of our experience now? And if it could, is that meaningful? So that's kind of what I want to talk about in the second half. So we've talked about the chain, contact, feeling, craving, clinging. Can it be broken? The Buddha said it could. And so in our experience, where could it perhaps be broken? And there may be several points that it could be broken. I don't want to say this is the only point. But traditionally, the answer is that it gets broken between feeling and craving. And what this means is contact happens, a feeling tone arises, but we don't have a reactive mental formation of greed, aversion, or delusion in relation to it. This is a key point we've talked about many times. We hear it from you in interviews. This is the development of acceptance. A painful experience can be arising and you accept it the way it is. A pleasant feeling can be there and you don't need to hold on if it's passing. This is also the description of the mind of equanimity. Different kinds of pleasant and unpleasant are happening, but the mind is balanced and not getting lost in reaction to them. So the understanding in dependent origination is that contact happens, feeling tone follows, but no craving arises. Sometimes, obviously, sometimes. Sometimes we're caught. Even in periods of relatively good mindfulness, we still get caught. But sometimes we don't. And that's the breakthrough. That's the open door. Sometimes we can have pleasant and not get caught in greed, unpleasant, not get caught in aversion. So what we want to look at if we want to open up this quality of freedom in practical terms is this relationship to pleasant, unpleasant, neutral that doesn't get reactive. And the way I feel it, the way many people feel it, is that there's space around the feeling tone. There's a space that we don't fill with craving. So one Buddhist teacher put it this way. The whole of the Buddhist path is resting in the gap between feeling and craving. The whole of the path is resting in that gap. Here, gap doesn't necessarily mean a time gap, because sometimes these factors in the links go really, really quickly. And you may not perceive any time gap between feeling and the arising of craving. So I'm not trying to suggest there's always a time gap there. You might use the word space, resting in the space around feeling when craving is not arising. So what is that like? And I know you've experienced it many times during the days here. People describe it differently. I might use the word free, but other qualities that you might describe it as are things like ease, peace, spacious, non-conflicted, light, contentment, warm, friendly, compassionate. This space can have all these different qualities and ways that it will feel to you as you actually touch it. So there's something interesting going on here. Feeling has arisen, but no reaction has come to it, neither to pleasant nor unpleasant. That means that the mind is not being controlled or determined by the phenomena that are impinging on it. This is really important. The mind is not being determined by the phenomena. The phenomena are conditioned and always coming and going with this mix of pleasant and unpleasant. And mostly the mind is kind of determined by its reaction, habitual, unthinking, deluded reaction. But now, it's not. So, we could say that conditioned things are coming, but the mind's relation is not being conditioned by them. So there's something a little bit unconditioned in this gap between feeling and craving. I'd like to read this quotation from Ajahn Chah. It's a little bit long, but I hope you'll stay with it. The Buddha talked about conditioned and unconditioned things. Conditioned things are innumerable, material or immaterial, big or small. If our mind is under the influence of delusion, it will proliferate about these things, dividing them up into good and bad, pleasant and painful, likes and dislikes. Why does the mind proliferate like this? Because there is still the belief that all these things are oneself or belong to oneself. The tendency to conceive things as oneself is the source of suffering, birth, old age, sickness, and death. This is the worldly mind spinning around and changing at the directives of worldly conditions. This is the conditioned mind. The unconditioned refers to the mind that has seen the Dhamma, the truth of conditioned things as they are, as transient, imperfect, and ownerless. When we know conditions as neither ourselves nor belonging to us, we let go of conditions and attain the Dhamma. We enter into and realize the Dhamma. When we attain the Dhamma, we know clearly. So as we rest in this gap, we're not moving into craving, into clinging, and into selfing. We're not taking birth. So this gap could be described as something unborn and undying. And it has a little bit of the flavor of the unconditioned. So it is sometimes called deathless. In fact, there are a number of terms that point to this experience of the gap in the Thai forest language. It has been called deathless by many. Deathless, you should know, in the Buddhist language is a synonym for nibbana, for the unconditioned, for the ultimate aim. Ajahn Buddhadasa, another Thai forest teacher, called it temporary nibbana. It's not the full nibbana. It's not the complete experience of the unconditioned, but he called it a temporary nibbana. It's like a little preview or a little taste of it. Some other words that you might hear are pure mind, because the mind is free of greed, aversion, and delusion at that time. There's a purity about it. A great awareness or unentangled knowing. These are all pointing to this experience of peace or freedom or openness or non-clinging. So the reason this is significant is because it's a pointer. It's not the fullness of nibbana. It's not enlightenment. But it gives a little preview. And it's kind of like if you're walking down the street and there's a bakery nearby, you might catch the odor of bread being made. And you notice that and it's really nice. And you'd like to find out the source of it. So you just keep following that scent. And as it gets stronger and stronger, it's leading you to the bakery, or the bread factory. And then you get there and you get the bread. So this is similar. It's not exactly the fullness of nibbana, but it's a whiff of it. And as we catch the flavor of it and we follow it, it leads us to that source. It leads in that exact direction. There's this quite sweet section in the suttas where a bunch of Brahmin youths come to ask the Buddha some questions. And there's a whole cultural tale embedded here because the Brahmins were the religious elite of the time. And the wanderers like the Buddha were these poor rag robe wearing shavelings running around and living, you know, on the cheap in the forest. So for the Brahmin, rich Brahmin youth to come and ask questions of these recluses, it's a very nice cultural crossover. So this Brahmin youth is named Todaya, and he asks the Buddha, For one who is freed, what is that liberation like? Wouldn't you love to ask the Buddha that? What is that liberation like? And the Buddha replied, that sage is without desire. He has nothing. He is unentangled in becoming. So this word becoming is used to refer to this same process of grasping, turning one into a self. This is again from Ajahn Chah. You can imagine Ajahn Chah giving this little part of a discourse in an open-air hall in Thailand where there's a floor, there's a roof, but there are no walls on the side. There are just pillars supporting the roof. So the Dhamma goes out from this open-air setting. Ajahn Chah said, and you can imagine him pointing, the roof is a becoming. The floor is a becoming. But in the empty space between the roof and the floor, there's nowhere to stand. When there is no becoming, that's where there's emptiness. And to put it bluntly, we say that Nibbana is this emptiness. So for us, when we're not taking a stand on something, some contact, then there's emptiness. And that emptiness is this temporary Nibbana. When we're not grasping, this flavor is there. And it's considered a deathless place because it hasn't been constructed through taking birth. It doesn't come about through manufacturing or through doing. It comes about through not doing. And because it comes about through not doing, that is, not grasping, it's always available in every moment. So it has this quality of being unborn and undying. It's always potentially there. This is from Ajahn Jumnian, another Thai forest teacher. The best way to develop a great awareness is to rest your attention within that knowing space of consciousness, in the pure space of knowing. If you understand and can rest in this pure knowing, that is the place of the deathless. From this pure consciousness that's unmoved by what arises, then you see the phenomena of the world, which all have the nature to arise and pass away. Phenomena show their dharmas of impermanence, and this other is the dharma of the deathless. When I was a monk, I spent time with Ajahn Buddhadasa, another of the great Thai forest masters, at his monastery in the south of Thailand. Ajahn Buddhadasa was very skilled at resting in this gap of emptiness. And I found his presence a little bit intimidating. He's this very interesting teacher. He was both a scholar and a great practitioner. But he lived quite simply. And it was the days before his monastery became really famous and a lot of tour buses were drawing up to the gates. He was very available. So generally he'd have his breakfast in the morning and then he'd go sit on this bench outside his house. It was just out in a patch of cleared earth, nothing fancy, not paved, not concreted. And the village dogs would be wandering around. They seemed particularly skilled at detecting Westerners because they would bark at us, but not the Thai monks. There would be chickens scratching in the dirt at his feet. And if you wanted, you could just go up. He'd be sitting on his bench. You could go up and ask him questions or talk with him. So occasionally I would do that, but I found it quite intimidating because Ajahn Buddhadasa, when I approached, he didn't like put out the welcome mat particularly. You know, you go into an interview with a Vipassana teacher and we almost offer you a cup of tea, you know, and a box of tissues and a nice chair and everything. Ajahn Buddhadasa just kind of looked at me and I could ask my question, but there was no sense of, you know, reaching out to welcome particularly. And so I got the feeling he didn't really want me to be there. So I would not do it all that often, and then I would, you know, scurry away. But when I got to know him better, I realized that he wasn't wishing I was gone. He was just resting in this place of non-grasping and equanimity. So just the way he meditated all the pleasant and unpleasant contacts in his day, he was meditating me. So I came there and I was just another arising in his field. He didn't care if I stayed or went. It was all fine with him. I could have hung out for an hour and asked questions and probably even been really obnoxious. But I didn't realize that. So only later did I realize he was meditating me the whole time from this place of a lot of equanimity. So this is the place of unentangled knowing. You can see it's not particularly dependent on a kind of object, although it can arise from being with objects like the breath or sounds or sensations or choiceless attention, but it doesn't have to. More the quality is this great openness and a lack of fixation or clinging to anything that's arising. So I want to just mention a couple of meditation approaches that lead in this direction. The first one is one I think we've alluded to a few times, but I don't know if we've quite spelled it out so clearly yet. And it was one of the teachings of Sayadaw Utejaniya, the Burmese teacher that I know we've mentioned several times. He has a practice that he describes as right attitude, checking on the right attitude for meditation, where periodically he suggests turning inwardly and asking the question, is there greed, aversion, or delusion active in this moment? Well, in the beginning, that's not so easy to know. So he has three questions to help us find that out. So to see if there's greed present, the question is, are you wanting something else to be happening now? And this happens quite a bit, doesn't it? That we would like something else to be happening? Take a look and see. You find yourself thinking about, you know, the concentrated sitting or the sense of relaxation or the mind not wandering. So that's the question for greed. Are we wanting something else to be happening now? To check on aversion, you ask the question, do I wish something would stop happening? And that reveals the presence of disliking. And to check on delusion, you ask the question, am I in touch with what's happening? Usually by the time you ask the third question, you are in touch. And so the answer to that is usually no, or, you know, or I am in touch, at least to that level of delusion. It's a very simple meaning for delusion. Am I in touch? Am I present? So these are the three questions. Is there greed, meaning am I wanting something else to happen? Is there aversion? Am I wanting something to stop happening? Is there delusion? Am I not in touch with what's happening? As I started to practice with these questions, which he's written about in one of his books, I would just be doing a standard mindfulness practice, something like choiceless attention, and then several times during a period of practice, either sitting or walking, I'd just turn and ask these questions. I'd stop doing my other technique. I'd just turn and ask these questions. Then if I found one of these, greed, aversion, or delusion, I would just be mindful of that. Just pay attention to that, feel that. Not judging it, not trying to make it go away, but just taking it as the new object for mindfulness. And it became a really interesting exploration. So in the beginning, as I was learning this practice, I would do that maybe five times during a sitting or a walking. I would turn and check on my attitude. As it got more familiar, I could do it more frequently. And as I got more stable with my attention, I could use that as my primary meditation inquiry. So as the mind got stable, I could use looking at attitude as the main thing I was doing. If I started to get distracted, then I'd come back, you know, world of simple sense objects. But I could turn and be with that for periods of time. This is from Upasika Ki. So, your awareness has to take a firm stance right at the mind in and of itself. When mindfulness is standing firm, the mind won't be affected by the objects of sensory contact. If mindfulness slips and the mind goes out latching onto things, troubles will arise. So you have to keep checking on this in every moment. There's nothing else that's so worth checking on. So this is one of the ways we can explore to stay in touch with that open and unentangled sense of knowing, checking on the qualities of greed, aversion, and delusion, and it opens us up more and more into this kind of empty space. The other approach I want to suggest, we'll give more instruction on in the next few days. Maybe we'll do a guided meditation in the morning on it. But for now, I just want to describe it simply as turning your attention to the process of awareness itself. So let's just play with this for a few seconds this evening. So let your eyes be open and look around the room and see things that you like and don't like. Just kind of let your eyes wander and, you know, take a hold of different objects. You know, there's some pretty colors. Somebody's got a nice shawl on. There's a nice orderliness to the rows of zabutons. You like the image of the Buddha that's up there. The lit candles are beautiful. Maybe there's some things that you don't like so much. You know, the way... I won't go into it. Let your eyes just roam around, you know, sort of settling on objects here and there as you go. So in that, can you kind of feel yourself getting drawn out, latching onto things, moving outward, taking a hold, liking, disliking, kind of busy, okay? Now, let the attention come back toward the awareness itself. What is looking? Pose the question, what is looking? Does that make any kind of shift inwardly? Does it feel different than going out? So it may. It may be subtle, but the going out kind of hooks us into objects. The asking the question, what is looking, takes us more inward and detaches us a little bit from the objects that we may have been a little caught up in. So this property of turning the attention to awareness itself can lead directly into this kind of unentangled knowing. There are a few ways to get there, a few terms. Turn the attention to awareness, become aware of awareness, turn awareness back on itself, ask who is aware, ask what is knowing. These are just some different ways to get into this mood, you might say. So focusing on the knowing takes us out of being so close with the phenomena, with the appearances. This again is Upasika Ki. The mind that's aware of awareness doesn't send its knowing outside this awareness. Nothing can be concocted in the mind when it knows in this way. In other words, an inward staying, unentangled knowing. All outward going knowing cast aside. So this is the quote that we started with in the beginning. When we turn toward awareness itself, we don't tend to get as entangled with the phenomena. We don't seek to know something or own something or claim something beyond awareness itself. So we're not concocting when we know in this way. An inward staying, unentangled knowing. So inward staying, as you might be experiencing now a little bit, it doesn't mean we cut off from the world. This is different from like a samadhi absorption that takes us away from sense contact. When we turn toward awareness, all the phenomena at the sense doors are still known, and maybe even more clearly. So we're not cutting ourselves off, but we've stepped back from being quite so grabby with them, quite so entangled with them. So these are just two meditative approaches that can sort of lead in this direction of unentangled knowing. Truthfully, any Vipassana meditation technique can open us up and will open us up to this quality. These two emphasize the turning toward the mind more directly, and so they may be helpful for some of you as more direct routes in this way. But all of our practice is leading to this breaking the chain of dependent origination between feeling and craving because of this strong establishment of mindfulness there, so that we're not caught in these reactive formations. We start to feel in our own experience this presence of the deathless, this temporary nibbana, this pure mind, this preview of the ultimate reality. So I'll just end the talk with another quotation from these dialogues with the Brahmin youths. And this is a young man named Kappa who has come to ask a question of the Buddha. For one stranded in the middle of the lake, in the flood of great danger, overwhelmed with aging and death, tell me the island, dear sir. The Buddha replies, having nothing, clinging to nothing, that is the island. There is no other. That is nibbana, I tell you, the total ending of aging and death. So let's just sit for a minute together. Having nothing, clinging to nothing, that is the island. There is no other. That is nibbana, I tell you, the total ending of aging and death.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.